So we did get a challenge at the Presbytery meeting on Friday from the moderator about how our methods are not necessarily the best. So that in the 90s and 2000s, and he was giving specific reasons for why First Presbyterian Orlando, which is really one of the flagship churches of the EPCO, started to actually change some things because they've been finding that their discipleship and their means of evangelism just aren't working. They're kind of just holding the edge. Not a whole lot of adult professions of faith. I don't know why they did this, but it was interesting that they actually had a flourishing preschool ministry, if I understand correctly. It was kind of late at night, and they actually shut it down. The session actually decided it was filling seats and everything, but they decided that that's not, or believe that's not where the Lord is leading them to be on mission as a church. So I thought it was interesting that they actually shut down their preschool. He didn't really give long reasons why, but I thought it was interesting that as an elder board, they had thought through this, prayed through it, and fasted. Now, one of the unique things about our church is we're quite small compared to First Presbyterian Orlando. So we're not at, I don't know how big they are. My guess is a couple thousand people. So we're quite small compared to First Presbyterian Orlando. So we're a little bit confined sometimes to what we can do as a church and missionally what we can do as a church. So we went, I'm not going to go all the way back to the slide, but I had mentioned the current goal for the congregation is to get to a critical mass of people. And then the next goal that I would set for session is how do we get to 100 people? And then you think, you don't want to get too far ahead of yourself. We are where we are. But I'm going to argue this morning that friendship should be the primary vehicle for growth in our church. So I have two little girls there. I was thinking specifically in our missional friendship that we've had with our neighbors, the Yazkins, and Zoe and Mila have become buddies, and they're not quite that old yet, but I was trying to, I pulled on Google Images and thought, well, this is kind of what missional friendship has looked like to me. So I thought of Mila and Zoe holding hands maybe and walking when they get older. So that's kind of where I'm going from here. So Case Thorpe did give us a really kind of like a pep talk. Would you say it was like a pep talk, Bob and Laurie? He's really funny. What? Yeah, he actually did do cheers, which I promise I will never do for you. Yeah, so. And he also said that you don't have to wear skinny jeans to grow your church. So I think I recall saying that joke in the past. And if anybody dressed like the stereotypical Presbyterian minister, I think Case Thorpe would be right up there with. He had mentioned that his daughter said a phrase, an idiom, "Oh, that boy is so basic," which means you're boring, apparently. Matt's laughing. Have you heard of this phrase?
Yeah, it takes a while.
Okay. But if I ever thought there was a denomination that is, quote, basic, maybe the EPC would kind of fit that role. So, or at least that's how maybe I'm just showing that I'm aging and I'm middle-aged now that I can't pick up on those terms either.
He does kind of look like you, but you're more
down. Yeah. Yeah, this picture looks a little bit different than he looks in person. That always amazed me. So he communicated to us. Another really good thing about the EPC is they're doing a really good job at transitioning power to the Gen Xers. So the baby boomers are starting to retire, which is a pretty big demographic for our church specifically right now. But one of the things I really like about the EPC is, unlike some of the other denominations, the baby boomers aren't holding on to power. They're giving it off to the next generation. So Case Thorpe is probably about Nate Devlin's age, my mentor. And our presbyteries had a few moderators that are a little bit younger. So it's nice that they give over power to some younger guys to kind of vision cast for what the future is going to look like. But he kind of gave us a pep talk because he did a cheer again. I promise not to do that. But he's a little bit concerned that our denomination isn't living up to the expectation of where it should be. And he was talking primarily about adult professions of faith, that we lag behind. We're kind of stagnant. One of the sad things that I learned at the clergy luncheon that I went to on Thursday was the POA has 5 churches that might be shutting down, so you could be in prayer for those churches. But we have a lot of churches that are stagnant or in decline. So we have a lot of challenges facing us. And Case Thorpe basically just wanted to be up front with us, so I'm kind of communicating what our moderator said. So he stated old models are not working. He didn't specifically give a model how to vision cast for the future. That's where missional friendship comes in. At least I think that's how we can do things here at RPC. But from what I was hearing from his voice, again, I'm interpreting him, is are we willing to sacrifice a lot of things that we hold dear to our hearts and to build friendships, or this is how I'm interpreting him, to build friendships with other people that might not be in our social networks currently. So again, old models are not working, so it's imperative for leaders of the church to vision cast for the future on how to do new modes and methods for ministry. Okay, so friendship and faithful presence. So faithful presence is a title or a word phrase that I've stolen from a sociologist named, now I can't remember his name. He teaches, I know where he teaches. James Davison Hunter, that's his name. He teaches at University of Virginia. He's a Christian. I think he might be Episcopalian or Anglican. But he's studied the church from a sociological perspective. And he actually advocates a method for doing ministry that is not transformational. So we're not trying to totally transform culture. And it's not pulling back, so to speak, like fundamentalists did. But he advocates for what's called faithful presence. And I think friendship through faithful presence is the way to go. So we faithfully are present in the world and we witness to the reality of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when people interact with us, they should think about the life to come. And I'm going to vision cast this through friendship. So again, we're a smaller church. So I'm going to say friendship doesn't cost anything. So you can do it. It's cheap. There's no overhead. And friendship, to be quite honest, is the best way to share the good news of the gospel with other folks. Okay, so friendship and faithful presence. Churches can and should do mercy ministry. I would put an emphasis on make that like an imperative. But they should realize that their primary objective is to worship God. So mission flows out of worship. And I believe we're going to see that over and over and over again throughout the book of Acts. The disciples come together, they pray, they fast, they hear a sermon, and then they go out. So if you reimagine that in our Reformed context, throughout the week we come into the Lord's presence on the Lord's Day, throughout the week as individuals, but principally on the Sabbath. We come to worship and witness to the risen Christ, and from that we go back out into the world to be faithfully present in a world that does not know Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. So again, mission flows out of worship. I hope that I've done a decent job as your pastor for the last year and almost a half already. That's all. Time flies, really. Almost a year and a half, year and 4 months. But putting a strong emphasis that worship really matters and church really matters. I think sometimes people make the mistake about talking so negatively about the church. But I always want to... Now, it doesn't mean that we're not critical of the church, but at the same time, we need to be positive about ministry really matters and worship really matters on Sunday afternoons. So friendship and faithful presence. So I like to play a game with a lot of my friends that did not grow up in the United States and ask them what, because one of the hard things about being an American, if you haven't lived extensively overseas, if you might not have friends that are from different countries, they are more attuned to cultural idols than you are not as an American, or as specifically where you might live. So as an American, I can go to Mexico, and I've done this with, it's easy for me to pick up on stuff in Mexico, for example, that I would say doesn't jive with scriptural witness. But vice versa, it's easy for Sarah to pick up on things in America that are not faithful to scripture and kind of challenge those things. So since I've learned that over the years, and I actually lived in a different country for close to 2 years, and it gave me a whole framework to how to think about things. I never really realized how much I just assumed from the world that I lived in, and how the United States has its own distinct things. But one of the things that I like to ask people is, so what are some of the things that you don't like about the United States? And almost most of my friends that come from a different context will tell me that Americans don't do friendship very well. So I think that's it's a question. It's what they repeat over and over and over again. We had a French student. She was an intern at Radius, and she actually said that too. So this was about 6 months ago. She said, I love America. I love all the things about it, but it seems like a very lonely place, and there's not the deep friendships that I've grown up with in France. So, yes, Bob?
You made a really interesting comment a few minutes ago, and I know you didn't mean this, but you said friendship evangelism. Making relationships, making friends, there's no overhead. I think of Shore as a, that's not true.
That
was financially. But I think that's part of our problem with not being good friends, is we're so oriented toward our inward self-actualization that, friends don't fit into that unless they help us. I was looking at the paper today in Korea magazine, that they had a list of new shows, and one of them, and this is sort of the paradigm, it's interesting. He was in the show about her being a doctor. It's her second career, and she's had all of those things that everybody's had now. She has a child, she has had her divorce, got that tiger, and now she's going to become self-actualized when she's 6 years old. It's kind of pathetic, but that is where our self-actualization culture has gotten us, that we have lived to the point where we're now ready to retire and die, and none of the things that should have been created in our lives, none of the support systems, none of the really meaningful, significant aspects of life have we had an opportunity to enjoy because we've been so eclipsed by the need to satisfy my personal individual desires. So, if there was one thing, I've never lived outside of American culture, but I would think that from within it, even within it, I see that.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Just to give an example, when I spent a week in Monterey last year, and we will again this year, my mother-in-law is friends with everybody on her street. So that's a little bit different than sometimes what happens, at least I'm guilty of this too. Yeah, when I meant low overhead, I meant financially because of where our church is right now. So we don't have to program to do friendship. You can just go out. It will cost you a lot of date nights and things like that. I'll talk about that. It's a lot easier. It will cost you a lot because it's hard to have somebody over for dinner every other Friday. I mean, you want your time with your spouse, for example, than being friends with somebody else. But I was just amazed that my mother-in-law knows everybody on her street intimately, and they just kind of like come and go in her house. It's kind of like a throwback to what my grandparents, it's how they grew up in the north side of Pittsburgh, for example. So, yeah.
It takes time. A lot of time to build those relationships.
Yeah.
I think when you said that's what it costs, that's what I was saying. How friendship does take time.
Yeah.
You don't have the time.
Yeah. So another, the cost comes with time because everybody now is placing. I sent a picture to Dean the other day. There's a business in the Renaissance Center that put busy in their like mission statement. I thought that was the most bizarre thing in the world. But it's interesting that busy is a sign of importance in our culture. So if you're busy, but it's also interesting that people kind of sit back and play video games by themselves and do things like that. So, but busy is a word. If you want to kind of flex your muscles and talk to somebody and say you're important, you'll often hear people saying the word busy. So I try to tell pastors not to say busy because then it's off-putting to people and then they don't want to approach you and develop a relationship with you. So it's just interesting that culturally speaking that is something that comes up. And again, I'm being biased because I'm talking about my demographic and under. I think older generations do friendship better than my demographic. So I'm biased because I'm approaching it from a certain framework too. So just to be upfront, there's no such thing as complete unbiased. I've learned that throughout life and a lot of reading over the time. Everybody's kind of got their own biases. So RPC and friendship. I actually don't think I'm picking on something that we don't do well. So I actually think RPC does friendship really well. That's one of our strengths as a congregation. So what I just stated, I'm not challenging us, so to speak, that we don't do friendship well as a congregation. We do it quite well. Everybody has been a part of each other's lives going back decades. So that's a really good thing. So you guys have thick friendships with one another. But this kind of goes with the cost of what Bob is talking about and what I'm going to try to challenge us to do. But perhaps we need to make friends outside of our established social networks that we already have. Maybe we've exhausted those ones already. So the key is to kind of sacrifice some of your friendshipness, I guess, if that's even a word, with the current people that you have these thick relationships with, and try to reach out to others. And that's kind of the social cost that will come, or the overhead that will come with that. So I'd like to challenge you to be really intentional. And you can do that through programs like the one sermon last week or the week before I had mentioned, joining a group at the public library. Or there's all kinds of different groups that are going on in Erie where you can use those as a means to build friendships with other people. So Sarah went to a swimming class for Zoe. I had mentioned that last week for young mothers. That's a means to build friendships. Or another young couple, coincidentally, with a daughter that's 1 month older than Zoe, moved in across the street. So it's pretty funny how the Lord providentially puts people in your life and right in front of your face, so to speak, when you see them every day. So there are means to do friendship out there. So Sarah said that there is a grandfather that was there, so you could play that role. Maybe you could hang out with the grandfather that she said, oh, that's a little bit weird that Grandpa was just kind of watching a bunch of women swim with their kids. I don't know if you... Yeah. Well, you could talk to that guy. But yeah, I think, or I don't know, join the gym and then just talk to random people. I had breakfast the other day with the rep for the DTS alumni guy at Eden Park. He just was like talking to everybody. I was like, man, he like kills me in the friendship department. I get a little bit uncomfortable just walking up to random people and interrupting their lunch, but people liked it. So it was a little bit different, but I could tell that he maybe had the gift of evangelism more than I do, and that was just something that he could do. But he was doing at Eden Park and just talking to people and getting to know them and things. So some pastors do that, but I like to be a little bit more intentional with my friendships that way. Okay, so RPC and friendship. Missional friendship is one of the ways we can be a prophetic witness in the world for Jesus Christ. So my argument is going to be friendship is at an all-time low in American life right now. And I've been reading articles in the New York Times, sociological data. If you want to read more and just not take my word for it, I can point you to all of these studies. So, America and friendship. And again, I'm probably being biased because I'm talking about my experience. But there is a really interesting article I could send you that the New York Times ran, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, that said, why is it so difficult to make friendships over when you hit 30? They were finding out that once you hit 30, it's really hard to form new friendships with people. This is specifically the case with singles sometimes if they don't get married by the time they're 30. My friend, she's single, she's a year older than me, actually shared the article with me, which was bizarre to me because in seminary, if there was ever a person that was friends with everybody, it was my friend Brittany. And I thought it was weird that she said, basically, once I hit 30, I stopped having the ability to make friends. So what did the New York Times article find? Interviews with people talking about friendship, they started to take a consumeristic bent in how one chooses friends. So age segregation was one. So Jim can't come to the young mom's swimming group. So age segregation, sex segregation. One of the most alarming things for myself is a lot of people that they're interviewing were talking about when they're talking to somebody and meeting them, much like dating, they were grading people on a 1 to 10 scale on how good of a friend they could be. So instead of asking the question, I'm going to argue that the doctrine of election, of God electing us, basically tells us we don't get to pick who our friends are. If you think about it that way, if you really have that doctrine sink down into your heart, it will change it. But I've actually caught myself doing this before in the past. You talk to somebody and you're automatically going through in your head, do they meet this category? Do they meet this? It's just kind of the world that we live in. So I think we have to be like really careful not to cast it in that light. But I mean, it's different when you're reading in the New York Times and they're talking about this young people scale, like basically grading people on a 1 to 10 scale. And if you do that all the time, you're probably going to end up with no friends anyways, because there's not perfect people, or not everybody you're a very unique individual, so to expect everybody to be like you is just not going to happen. So any observations about that or experience, or maybe in your life you've felt that that's changed over time, viewing friendship that way?
I have kind of a different experience in recent years.
Okay.
Since I jumped back into work full time, and since there's all this bubbling in Erie about the future of Erie, and that cuts across from our mayor, who's older than I am, to, you know, the Jefferson Society Erie Reader guys. And so I find there's a lot of professional friendships across demographics, and I see the same people at different events that I, you know, maybe I'm on Philharmonic with them, but maybe they're involved in politics. So I find that I have a ton of professional friendships, and I have made friends with younger people through my work and through our, you know, from the EDC, that leadership of that group is young. And so you kind of, and especially in organizations I'm in, you know, you have affinity for whatever, you know, whether it's the orchestra or the Phil chorus or whatever, with people who are of all different ages, but you have that common thing. At the same time, you've got kids, my kids' age, you know, who are swiping right or left, making a decision on making a friendship with a person that they don't have, they didn't start with, oh, we're on this board together, or we go to the same church, or we, you know, they're just starting with basically, we're about the same age and are looking for a date. I mean, that, you know, I mean, obviously some algorithm is deciding they could maybe be friends. That's creepy to me, and I don't really get that. But I do think, you know, I have friends here and friends, people, a lot of people I would call my friend, but it's at a certain level of friendship. You know, they've never been over at my house, or I've never been to their house, because I feel like there's a privacy we all like about our own life that you want to keep those friendships where they are and not go deeper.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I'm trying to juxtapose against. I'm trying to advocate, take the extra step and have people and do life together with them, not just, because sometimes I'll call the boards programs. It becomes kind of programmatic instead of a deep, like in the church world, we have deep, long-lasting relationships with people. People come over to our house. It's more intimate. So maybe that's the witness that Christian friendship is different than.
The funny thing is, though, like, if the trust develops between those people, you have to have the same relationship where you feel like you're asking a question, and now I'm going to take it, and we'll answer you because, you know, I mean, I feel like I've developed a full network of people that are available to answer the question that I have any time of the day, or just make a funny comment about something that we usually care about. Or so it's weird, but I do think when you're younger and your kids are little, you maybe take more risks at inviting people, because you're also trying to build friendships for your family and your children. So, like, I remember going to swim class, and
yeah, no, that's true. I think that's why it said, why is friendships harder to form after you get to 30? Because it seemed like the sociologists are tracking a certain, you do take more risks when you're younger, so that is correct. Dean?
I think the thesis brought up a point that I find very interesting in my life, and the way that I would characterize it, if I would characterize the difference between Facebook and LinkedIn. And for those of you that may not be familiar with what LinkedIn is, it's a Facebook for professional people. And you basically are connected on LinkedIn because of who you are professionally as opposed to who you are personally. So in my Facebook world, almost never does anybody ask me to be their friend. the connections that I have on Facebook are largely based upon experiences that are shared on a personal basis, some going back 50 years, and the connection, even though Facebook hasn't existed that long, the people that connect on Facebook are connecting with some personal aspect of your life that you have in common with them that has nothing whatsoever to do with your professional position. On the other hand, on LinkedIn, I am constantly bombarded by people who ask to connect to me. And that's because of my professional reputation in the field where I spent my career working. And still have, even though I'm retired and not active anymore in that field very much, I still have a reputation that has continued over time, so that there are people that want to connect with me. And I, as I'm thinking and listening to Lisa, I think what Lisa probably doesn't, well, maybe she does, but I don't think she does, she's a pretty humble person. I don't think Lisa realizes the status that she has because of her words and media. And so I can easily see why people in a whole wide range of situations can see value in connecting with Lisa and would be more than happy to respond to her text or make connections in various meetings and so on.
Hey, I've used Lisa as somebody that goes to our church, not to pick on you, Lisa, like, hey, or when we talk about Radius, I'm like, Lisa did a story, and then that's how I ended up here. So, yeah, people know who, that's true.
Yeah, that's not a bad thing. I mean, that's actually a good thing, that because Lisa has a, you know, really warm and loving personality, she can make hay with that in terms of connecting with a wide variety of people that someone like me, for example, wouldn't be able to. And I think that's how God uses each of us in a different way. But there is an interesting, this when you talk about consumerism as an American trendship, there is something that's defined in there because of the connection people are willing to reach out and try to connect with me on LinkedIn, where almost never did anybody reaching out. Even people that I know quite well haven't reached out to me to seem to be my friend on Facebook, despite the fact that I'm constantly bombarded on Facebook. Wouldn't you like to connect with this person or that person? I'm sure they are as well, but they haven't made that leap. I'm basically a shy person.
No, that's true. And maybe through talking through this, I'm kind of getting at is friendship, Christian friendship is distinctly different. And I actually think Paul's letters pick up on this, where he'll invert things, where things are kind of the ways of the world, not that the world. Yeah, he'll talk about the ways of the world are different than in the church. So when you step into the church and we take communion at the Lord's table, we truly are all equal people. Like, nobody's of more significant worth in the eyes of the Lord than somebody else. So I think what's interesting is when people come to a healthy church, they automatically feel like it's a different society, basically, where they would see somebody who is of prominence, ideally acting like a very humble person in the church, like they're just another brother and sister in Christ. It's actually interesting that even Jesus used the familial language too. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to argue for, a distinctive Christian way of friendship where you would take more risks, because the early church took a lot of risks. They were over 30 years old. So, Bob.
This conversation is on the recollection of way back to last night. We have come into the late 20th century and gotten a new way of connecting civilization. Did you know you could stream content on your devices? It's apparently that's true. So, anyway. One of the things we were watching last night was a free movie channel that has commercials. And the commercial that came up all the time was for some outfit that's out there advertising to turn off their devices. And, you know, sort of Rob.com or something like that. The way street dinner, and it's like the doors look hilarious, and they're really funny, but it's someone feels so compelled that they're buying a lot of time to say, you know, this isn't really connecting with anybody. Be with the people that you're in the room with, and that's how you connect. These yep. other things feel like connections, but and on some level they are, of course, but they really aren't. And that might be part of, I mean, if something's going on in my life, I'm going to reach out to somebody who's flesh and blood. I'm not going to go to somebody who, as you say, I have a text relationship. I don't think I have a text relationship with anybody. But if I did, I'm not sure that's the person I would go to. You know.
Yeah, it's just interesting. There's kind of a weird paradox where we have all these connections, but everybody's constantly complaining about being lonely or not having any friends. What a difference between millennials and from what I'm hearing from campus ministers and Gen Z is a lot of complaints coming back to the campus ministers or people are like, I have all these connections, but I don't have any friendships. So that's kind of something that I'm hearing a lot. So I kind of live in between two worlds because I'm an elder millennial. So I grew up in the world where we had pagers for a while before texting. I never had one, but I remember pagers. That's a little bit different than texting. So,
in contrast with what Bob just said, though, I will say that probably a dozen times a week, somebody on Facebook that's a Facebook friend that's also a Christian will reach out to me either by message or email or whatever and say, this is happening in my life, will you please pray for me? And I also have a fairly significant number of people that travel extensively, and routinely when they post that they're traveling here or there, I have this little thing that I send that I say, I'll pray for you, your safety, for the pilots of your aircraft, and also that you'll have, you know, a safe time when you reach, you know, Timbuktu or wherever you're going. And I get an interesting, very positive feedback to that message. And that those are some of the people that then in turn will reach out and say, and there's some of these people I have never actually physically met. They became Facebook friends because I was Facebook friends with someone else that they knew, and they saw that there was a connection and so forth. So social media is a strange thing, but for someone like me who's very shy and doesn't do well one-on-one with people or even whatever, there's an advantage to that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Situation.
Okay, so we've defined the consumeristic. So I made this slide and was quite proud of myself. I thought it was pretty funny. So if you remember the lead campaign organizer for Bill Clinton, his famous statement was, it's all about the economy, stupid. And that's how they knocked off George H.W. Bush. So I said, oh, if he looks like an evangelist half the time. When he's from the South, so he, even though he's not a Southern Baptist, he looks like a fundamentalist Southern Baptist preacher in my mind, at least.
He also called Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia with a whole lot of Alabama in the middle.
Oh, interesting. It's probably true, actually. But I changed those words and said, it's all about the relationship, stupid. So if think about Carville when you're when the pastor's talking about it. So if we're going to be intentional, if friendship is a thing, there's going to be certain types of people, I think, that just from observation from the last year and a half, people that might be a little bit easier to become friends with than others. So the last census stated that 15%, this could change in the next census, so I'm eagerly awaiting 2020 to figure out the most live data. Lisa could correct me if I'm wrong on this, but 15% of people in Erie were born outside of Erie. Now, just reading sociology, people that are most likely to show up at a church or be open to coming over to your house, so if you're going to take a risk and invite people over, it's going to be within that 15%. So what are the types of people? So job transplants, specifically where we live, and the reason why we've actually stayed there longer is because we have a lot of job transplants there, LECOM students. So the best way to like get your foot in the door to form friendships with people is through people that didn't grow up here, that are here. Maybe they're a little bit lonely. have a little girl, for example, and or two people on our street that don't, and you can connect with them immediately instead of the thick relationships that they already have. Although sometimes that doesn't work, because I talked to a young dental student one time, and he's like, "What do you do for a living?" I'm like, "I'm a pastor." And he started blushing and got really shy. Like, he grew up Catholic, like he wouldn't confess to me or something, or to talk to me. I was like, "I'm not that scary. I can be your friend or whatever." But he just kind of kept walking. So sometimes it doesn't go as well as planned. But he was within that 15%. So it's a strategy that I've developed as a person, and I'm one of the 15% too. So I think it helps a little bit. So who are the 15% in Erie? We have a lot of immigrants. That's why we thought we were going to at Westminster, but we weren't able to do it. So keep praying that we find a building. But immigrants fit within that 15%. Moreover, they come from countries where relationships are even thicker than Americans who have really thick relationships. So they're people that really have a hard time sometimes when they move here. They don't have their parents, their great-grandparents. They have kids younger than us, et cetera. So I think that that's a specific demographic that we could help through spiritual friendship or Christian friendship here in Erie. So if I meet people, I'll send them your way to become friends with them and have them over for dinner. Job transplants. And one thing from talking to Dean and Shirley is a lot of retirees, apparently, or there's a sizable population that comes here that didn't ever live here before because of our tax. Our taxes are quite friendly to retirees, so that's another demographic that I wouldn't have thought about, but is somebody that needs friends as well. So perhaps the harvest is ripe for RPC to intentionally look for people like this in our neighborhood. So being intentional. And it's interesting that Case Thorpe preached about this, and I think this is maybe a new idea, or it's not an old new idea, but it has old roots, but friendship is kind of the means. And again, low overhead cost-wise, not low overhead by giving up your time. Because remember, busyness means you're important in our culture, so nobody wants to give up their time. So, okay, so I've witnessed all these categories in Cherry Hill. So Sarah, Zoe, and I, that's why we continue to live there. Trying to look at time. Okay, so the apostles surprisingly do friendship too. So they had a strategy as much as, and we'll learn throughout Acts. Sometimes I don't think they have the best strategy. They just kind of wait for the Spirit to tell them to move, and they're obedient and go out and do their thing. But they had certain networks that they would go to first before they breached out to others. So I'll read a text this morning. One of the interesting things about Paul in particular is he tends to go, because he was a Jew, he goes to the Jews first, basically preaches Christ, looks for some people to trust in Christ, and when he feels like he's exhausted that social network, he goes to the Gentiles, and start, or God-fearers, who would have been the people that were kind of in that community. He probably picked up a lot of God-fearers to become Christians in the first century, and then he breaches out to do friendship outside. Paul, if there was ever a risk-taker, Paul's probably the best at it. I mean, that guy risked his life and eventually died for what he believed was of significant worth, which was the gospel. So, Acts 14, 1-7. Now at Iconium, they entered together into the Jewish, and you can kind of see this play itself out in the text, into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. Also notice the familial language, so just using the term brothers implies that there's more than a superficial friendship going on there. So they remained for a long time, speaking boldly for the Lord, who bore witness to the world of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided, some sided with the Jews, and some sided with the apostles. When an attempt was made both by Gentiles and Jews with their rulers to mistreat them and to stone them, they learned of it to flee to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and the surrounding country, where they continued to preach the gospel. So you can kind of see there's a strategy, even in, and we'll go over this as we work our way through Acts, there's a specific strategy to building relationships with people. And sometimes I think we think that the early church was like this huge, and it's true, on Pentecost there's a lot of converts, but first century churches were actually quite small. We tend to, And preachers, I'm probably just as guilty of this. We tend to maybe talk about them a little bit bigger than they actually were. So just to give you an example, St. Augustine's church was 300 people, which was a mega church at that time. And 300 people now is, I don't even know if it's categorized as a medium-sized church at the EPC, but I often like to think that my home church is, bless you, my home church was bigger than the congregation that the famous St. Augustine preached at. So that just shows how different things are. Even if you go back to the mega church model, that seems to be kind of, in friendship, that seems to be on its way out, or the writing on the wall is for that type of church. And it seems like parish church or smaller family-connected churches might be on the way in the future. So we'll see. I've read about a Korean church that I forget how many members they have, but it was just crazy. Or if you, for those who might have lived in the South, such as myself, some Southern Baptist churches have 20,000 people on the roll, which is just crazy to me. So, yeah. So, okay, so what is missional friendship? So specifically, be in prayer for our church to find a centralized location where we can actually have an English club for moms in the future. That's something that Session has voted on. So I had to change that around because I did this presentation back in June and had assumed that we're going to have a building, but we don't. So be in prayer for that. But if we're successful eventually in doing this, don't be surprised if the pastor asks you to adopt somebody as your friend. So we have to sacrifice our time and busyness. And sometimes I would even challenge you to take an inventory of your, quote, busyness and see sometimes what can be kind of chopped out, or, you know, it's almost budget time around the year. What can be kind of cut off? Or I catch myself saying, thinking I'm busy sometimes, but I actually have a lot more free time than I tend to think. Or what's worse is sometimes you go to hang out with people and you're like, man, I'd really like to just kick back and relax by myself. This happens to me all the time because I'm an introvert at heart. You have coffee, dinner, whatever you do with these people, and you come back, you're like, wow, that was a lot of fun. I'm really glad that I followed through with that. That kind of shows our sinfulness for being self-centered, that we'd rather just sit and kick back and relax by ourselves than actually take that over. I like what, thinking out loud of what Bob said, the overhead of cost to myself and my own time needs to go away. So that's missional friendship. So we do not get to pick members of our churches, so that's the doctrine of election. So we Presbyterians strongly believe in the sovereignty of God, and God elects those who are in the church. So if that doctrine gets deep down into your bones, that should influence for how you pick friends. It should not be, hey, what can I get out of this friendship from somebody? It should be, is the Lord putting this person in my life? Because I could be friends with them and share what matters most with them in my life with them. Have them over for dinner. Actually, I'd even say as modern people, we tend to think eating is not a sacred thing, but have you ever noticed when you do have somebody over for dinner or have lunch with them, how that forms a bond that's kind of spiritual that we tend to think as moderns that doesn't happen? But just to give an example of spending time in Mexico, it's common for people to have lunch together for like 2 hours. So when I moved back to the States and I would go out for these business lunches and they'd be like 30 minutes, I'd walk away and I'd just be like, what the heck was that? That was like, I didn't even get to say hello to the person. It really like changed my whole perspective on eating and sitting down with people. But I do think bonds and connecting with people when you actually sit down and or have them over to your house or go to a restaurant with one another, that really helps establish those bonds. We'll talk a little bit about that when I do my missions presentation too. There's a New Testament scholar named John Barclay, and he's doing work in this area with first century Christians, and it's reciprocity, it's called, in gift giving. He has a really, I think it's what the New Testament argues for, but a really interesting idea of reciprocity and gift giving with one another. So we'll talk about that in November. So picking missional friends. Studies have shown that to become friends with people, we tend to become friends with people 10 years older or 10 years younger. I've shared this with a bunch of people. I'm not going to expect you to be friends with somebody that's 3 decades older or younger than you. That's just not going to happen according to sociological data. Yes?
So does that mean a range of 10 years older to 10 years younger?
Yep, that's correct. Sorry to pick on you, Matt, but when I told this to Matt, he's like, wait, so am I going to have to like hang out with 14-year-olds? I was like, no, you can hang out with adults, but you have to wait till you get my age where it's like, I preached for Crew on Tuesday night, where I look at the Crew students, and I'm starting to see, okay, I'm going to be 33 this year. My cutoff for being sometimes making lasting, unfortunately, is just going to be harder with somebody that's more than 10 years younger than me. So
it's going to be harder. It doesn't mean it's wrong.
Yes. Yeah, but I just want to put that out there, because that's the general rule. So I'm not saying you don't go and be friends with younger or older people than yourself. That's not a good thing. But I'm just saying, this is kind of, on a practical note, this is what sociologists would point out. So so we already went over this. The next one, immigrants. Okay. I'm trying to get through. Oh, so this is an interesting example. So Abdullah, my friend from Radius, who came for Zoe's baptism, I had lunch with him. So this is interesting. We'll talk about gift giving in November. I took him out to lunch and paid for him. And what was interesting is that when I invited him, as that was like my gift to him, and his gift back to me was to come back to come to Zoe's baptism. But he actually left and works remotely for the same company in Saudi Arabia. He's from Saudi Arabia. And when I met with him, and he's like, oh, I'm leaving. And I saw him one day walking down State Street. I was like, hey, would you like to go get lunch again in the future just to chat? He actually was like, no, I'm actually going back to Saudi Arabia in 2 days permanently. I'm going to work remotely. But he said one of the things that was tough was he was having a really hard time forming friendships with people out of his ethnicity. But what was interesting is he was having a really hard time forming friendships. So since he could work remotely, he just elected to go back to Saudi Arabia. So I thought that was interesting, kind of going back again, asking questions to people who are from outside of our demographic, how that works itself out. So another example, I had a lot of experience. The reason why I asked Session to talk about an English club is most of the churches that I, from experience in Dallas who were growing, they did these English clubs, and they just had a ton of adult professions of faith coming in through them. And one of my friends, I used to go and hang out.
Could you tell us what an English club is? We don't really mean that.
I really don't know what it is. I'm still, basically what you do is, and so these were college students. They specifically targeted graduate students, a lot of graduate students in Dallas from China, for example. So my friends were Chinese Americans, but these were Chinese nationalists coming over, not literally Chinese nationalists, but from China. So since they were having a hard time forming friendships, they formed these friendship groups where they would invite students from the seminary who were not Chinese to come and hang out with them. So we would do fun things like go to Six Flags on the weekend, or we would go to dinners. And it was like a huge deal to them to just kind of like hang out and become friends. But one of the, and they were getting a lot of, so that they would be invited to church afterwards. They just weren't using, so they could practice English with me, and I would become friends with them. But they would use these clubs as a means to get people to come to church, and they established these clubs. But it was interesting hanging out with these students. Actually, one of the funniest things that happened was we went to Six Flags, and they told one of the girls to go on a roller coaster, which there's not really roller coasters in China, apparently. She stepped on and basically almost had a heart attack and didn't ride a ride the rest of the time. So it was kind of funny. I have to mention, I was 24 at the time, so I thought it was kind of funny. But the guy who ran this club, he got this idea from a sociologist friend. He was noticing that in Asians, for example, when they moved to the United States, if they hung out in a church for a year or more and formed lasting relationships, 95% of them professed faith in Christ after a year. But again, it was kind of this English club where it was actually an interesting way to come into the church, because in America, you kind of think like, oh, you have to get right with God before you can step foot in a church. Well, this approach was through relationships and just kind of like hanging out with Christians that they ended up professing faith. So did that help at all? Bob, or was I not being too clear?
Yes, thank
you. Okay.
It's not an ESL? I thought it was an ESL club.
Yeah, but sometimes the problem, so kind of going back to Case Thorpe's thing, Presbyterians tend to like over-program or make things too professional. I've actually been trying to push for this a lot at the Presbytery level as a younger person. And I think sometimes the problem is sometimes you want to make it too professional instead of, hey, let's just hang out together, read the Bible together, and practice English that way. Very informal. So I actually went to a meeting one time, and I've been pitching this, and my pastor friend wanted to do it with this church. I went to the committee meeting, and they started talking about doing all these programming and professionalism and stuff. And I'm like, well, why don't we just like start out small and change things on the fly? And so the concrete random, is that the thing, Dean? That's my concrete randomness, I guess you would say. Figure it out on the fly, get the people and figure it out. Yeah.
So why do we have to have a building?
I guess we don't.
Because what you're talking about doesn't require building.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, initially my thought was
international.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. Yeah, so maybe I could reach out to them because I had no idea that they even existed. So, yeah, that's something that we could think of since we're kind of in our tent strategy right now. But Sarah's friendship. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, and then Sarah's friendship with our neighbor is kind of a beta. It's kind of unfolding, so I wouldn't expect if that can blossom into something else in the future. The great thing about the church is they don't exist to promote themselves. They give a lot of free stuff, so people get interested in free things, so they'll show up. Sarah's brother's church has done this too, with Hispanics in particular. They had a real like niche people that they were thinking about, but it's a lot of fun. So, pastoral challenge. In order for us to grow as a congregation, it's going to be, at least at our size right now, I think, primarily done through friendship. That's, I think, small churches need to think that way. And that's where we are right now. Do not make decisions for people. I've been trying to say that a lot again. But I cannot stress the importance of this truth. We are not God, and He is the one who saves and builds His church. So be a little bit more responsive. Learn to be sensitive to the Spirit when you're forming friendships with others. Sacrifice some of your current friendships for the sake of the kingdom and meet new people. So for a lot of us, you might be shy. I'm shy. Sarah thought I was an extrovert when we first met, but I told her, no, I'm not. I'm an introvert at heart. I can make connections and professional connections with people, but at the end of the day, I like to be by myself. I can be a little bit of a loner sometimes. So, yes. So make some sacrifices. It's not, so for example, Friday night, you're probably going to have some people over. This is maybe something different that we have to start doing as an initiative as our church, but build new friendships with people. So, I'll stop there. Next week we're going to do biggest fears. So if you could either email me or submit your two biggest fears through paper. I forgot to bring paper to write that down. But you can email me, write it, rip off a piece of your bulletin, I guess, if you want to, at the end of the service, and give me your two biggest fears. So the thinking is behind Tim Keller came up with this idea, and he does workshops with people. He's found out if you can work through as a group the two biggest fears of the church to work through, it actually ups the ability, and you think through it critically, the ability to share the gospel with others and to think critically. I can think of what, at least...
Fears of what might come up when you talk.
Yeah, so like what sexual ethics would be, I would assume would be number one. That's a tough one to work through. But there might be some others. So,
suffering,
yeah, that would be a good one. How many roads are there to God might be one. I don't know if that's as popular as it used to be, but that's always come up in conversation with people as well. So, yeah, you might hit a bump in the road when you submit the seven essentials to them to look at, and they're like, oh, I don't agree with this, so would you work through something like that? But that might not be our number one issue plaguing our church. So we'll think through that next week. It'll be more of like a lab. I'm trying it. I thought it was a really good idea. It might work, it might not, I don't know. But I thought it would be good for us to think critically through how we can work through that. So, any questions?
Yeah. Tom? You're asking for two biggest fears. I don't understand what you want. About witnessing people or two biggest fears about witnessing people?
Witnessing to people. So, let's say you build a friendship with somebody, and then you start sitting down and chatting with them. People obviously start asking questions. And what are the two questions that you're horrified to get asked? So I have a slide, fear.
Fear of questions.
Yeah.
That you might be asked.
It's been my experience. I think Keller's correct. I think there are a lot of questions that people are just terrified to get asked that really hold them back from sharing with them. So. Any general observations or questions about the presentation?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be anxious.
Yeah, because just a commitment to one person, if you do it well, it's just a... That's why I think I've been trying to... Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not advocating go out and find 10 people, and that's just not sustainable. But if each one of us took one person that we were friends, and that was as a means to share the gospel with, that would double our size in our church, for example. We do need to get better at growth.
Well, I do think we're international.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a great place to go. Like, you can go to
Thailand,
too, to learn the culture. And they're going to want it. They want to know about our place. So you have that
opportunity. Yep. Yeah, you'll have to send me that information. I'll check it out. Any other? Bob, did you have an observation?
I was thinking about one thing that we did to expand our sphere of friendships was, or to create overlap, was when we do have good friends in the congregation, and when we would meet with those friends, we made an effort to bring our neighbors into that group of friends, so that this is an easy way of introducing them to the church, really. And that was singularly ineffective as a way of getting anyone into this church, or even to have very meaningful conversations about Christianity, but it might have gone different ways. They moved away. We scared them so badly. But what I want you to think about, or what I was going to say, is that my experience has almost universally been when I'm so... The questions that I'm so afraid someone asking me never are the questions that are on their mind. I mean, when you get to know someone, when people will always have those what I call barrier questions, which are questions that they use as a way of not having to address issues that they don't want to. So if they want to put you on hold, then they're going to raise those questions. And that's a conversation stopper, and they know it. And that's their way of saying, I don't want to talk about this. This is over. But when you really have communication with somebody, those are never the questions that you get asked. The questions you get asked are more about, well, you know, how is it that, you know, I kind of know you, and we have a lot in common. Why is that such an important thing to you? Or, you know, it's not even that objective many times. It's just getting to know someone, you naturally talk about things that... and those questions, the questions that come up are usually not the ones that you're most afraid of, I guess is what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
When they're real questions.
No, that's correct. But maybe it would still be good for us to... Maybe it's more about ourselves than the other people.
I think the conversations are really great when I'm looking forward to next week, because I have this huge... Everybody has that fear.
Yeah. Yeah, because I've been doing it. I got the nickname. I mentioned this at the search committee. When I worked, I came to faith in 19. I worked at Abercrombie & Fitch, which used to be cool. Apparently it's not cool anymore because they're closing like crazy. But I got the nickname on staff of Bible Doug. That's because I just formed relationships with people and talked about it. There's actually another window when somebody comes to faith for about 2 years. They're just super enthusiastic about their faith. So it's probably a little bit obnoxious for those 2 years. But... there was never any defeater questions that stopped them from being my friend. I would still chat with them during work and got along with them quite well. But that's correct. So
yeah, but you sometimes are making the assumption when you say make a friendship that everything is going to be a close personal friendship that lasts forever to the day you die, and it's just not virtually true.
Yeah. So
cast in that, and you have friendships on all kinds of levels, and you have opportunities to speak about your faith to people that are just business friends or casual friends, and conversations come up like that, and I think. You know, people say, well, we have to be intentional. No, you have to risk. And then we say we're shy. We're all shy.
And our culture shapes us to be shy, too. Laurie?
I've had the experience where I encourage someone and they start coming to church and then they become really good friends with somebody else, which is great, but certainly wasn't expected.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the... I think I'll sort of lose this and so did Tom. You don't want to screw it up. You don't want to sever the friendship that's budding by talking about things that are off-putting to somebody else, or you don't want to drive somebody away from being attracted to the church by having a wrong conversation. So, and then I think the political overlay of the last few years where Christians are assumed to be also having certain political views is a conversation stopper too. So it's, you know, I think kind of like Bob says, it's not so much of what question may come up as just is this a safe topic at all to open the door to. So I guess you want to protect the person from you.
Yes.
Somehow, and that sometimes.
But yeah, but in American life too, we're pretty superficial with what we talk about. That just to give a little bit. Yeah, I get that. I feel that cross pressure all the time. But at the same time, it almost feels like maybe this person is different. Maybe they actually do think about the most important topics in life. And it's been my experience. People don't think about that. So I'll give one example because I like to joke. At the co-working space that I just am a book nerd and like to think about this stuff. So everybody's like talking about authentic all the time. Or creative. And I'm like, yeah, you're so creative. Why is it that everybody basically does the same exact thing all the time? And somebody, because I've thought about this a lot, the tyranny of being different. And I'm like, yeah, but everybody that says they're different, they all have tattoos now. They all eat and drink at the same places. And I'm like, you're basically like everybody else. Like if you did a study of everybody wearing a suit to work in the 1930s or 40s, whatever, you're doing you just push to the opposite end. And they just look at me and they're like, why did you think about that? I'm like, well, I like thinking about things that actually matter in life. So it's freeing for me to just dress like basic person. To be a basic person is actually the most freeing thing in the world. And I didn't use that word in that conversation, but he just looked at me. He's like, oh, you're kind of onto something there. So it was just, yeah. So sometimes talking about the most important things in life actually opens up doors too. Or they just look at you like you're a weirdo and walk away.
But the biggest door there is what we're fed constantly. It's our culture that's feeding us.
Yeah.
In order to be basic, we have to work at it.
Yeah. No.
You know.
We're constantly reminded how awesome we are. The Lego movie, they had the song Everybody is Awesome. You can YouTube it. It's really, really funny. Chris Pratt, who I think is hilarious, he was on a show called Parks and Recreation, which is a funny TV show, but he sings the song, and he's like, drink my $7 latte, and he's like, awesome! And it just keeps going through the song, and they're just like, nonstop moving. That's the thing. Everybody's moving constantly all the time. To actually tell people, like, well, why do you do this? Or there's something more in life that matters. I think people are more open to that than sometimes. I think the busyness of life is kind of, they're afraid to ask those questions, I guess. I'm kind of thinking out loud, but...
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think the distraction of always having something to fill empty space, there's a reason why there's empty space in the world.
Yeah.
And... I think that's a huge problem in our culture and in our wired culture especially, is that nobody can ever just stop and be in a silent space. I love to drive the car because I never listen to the radio. I barely have a phone. I'll drive for hours, and that's a nice, quiet time just to reflect on. You're always having to be connected with people. This is the introvert we're speaking to, if I'm sure, but I do fear that we have not cultivated the virtue of silence as a physical spirit. And we haven't cultivated our culture even at a time where we're not distracted from some thing that we have to give our focal attention to. So that you can let the subterranean part of your brain sort of force those issues out and deal with it. You're always distracted by having to do something or occupied by something. You're suppressing those deeper questions.
Yeah, are the things that matter most in life? Like, why am I here? What is the purpose of life? Nobody's really asking those questions. It's all bent towards a technocratic society, which is not making people happy, it seems like. At least
trying to answer those questions about it, but they're not where they're asking.
Yeah, it's kind of a subconscious thing. It's interesting talk. Sarah and I had a Skype call with the pastor from Mexico that we're going to go, and the monks and us are going to go help them with some theological education. And every single time we talk to him, he's like, oh, yeah, we've been praying about this, this, and this. And in our American context, and it shows how Sarah's assimilated into our culture, we're just like, we're going to do, when we get on, we start talking about, like, what we're going to do. So we're kind of, like, coming at it from a different perspective. Not that we're not a praying family, but it just kind of shows our biases that doing stuff really matters. So, yeah, sitting, being silent is not something we like to do, or it's just weird, so... Okay, let's stop there. Thank you, guys.